Welcome to BridgeEd, the podcast brought to you by The Bridge here at Wellington College, where we'll be joined by a series of interesting guests to explore some of the most topical issues in the education sector. Well, hello, everybody. And today I am once again joined by the amazing Maria Arpa, MBE, the founder of the Centre for Peaceful Solutions. Today, Maria and I are going to be discussing some of the things that people understand and misunderstand about restorative approaches, restorative practice, about mediation, facilitation, and anywhere that the conversation takes me. So sit back and enjoy. Well, hello, Maria, and welcome back.
Well, surprise, surprise. Who'd have thought?
Great to have you back, as always. It's such a joy to talk to you. And I get so much out of these conversations, whether we record them or we don't. Yeah. It's always brilliant.
But isn't it lovely that we can share it? I mean, we've had so many of these conversations, and that, for me, is the joy.
It is, and what podcasts have brought this dimension to it, that we can have these conversations, but now we can share them. So. I was going to start today with something maybe going to sound maybe a little bit controversial perhaps to some people, but I heard a presentation not too long ago about restorative practice in schools, and I'm aware it's something that polarizes opinion a little bit. The central premise of the talk was restorative practice doesn't work if you do it badly.
Now. My
response to that was well, not many things work if you do them badly. I can make a pretty terrible lemon meringue pie or whatever. Yeah. But you know, that was essentially the message. And I'm also conscious, having done a little bit, just touched the surface of training myself, and to nowhere near the depth that you have, that it is something that needs to be done really particularly well if it's going to work. So. I'm curious from your perspective, so what stops people from doing restorative practice or restorative approaches in a school well, and what do schools need to do?
What a big question and a delight to be asked this. Absolutely. Like, can't wait to get into this. So there's a lot of resistance to restorative practice, because it is a philosophy change. It is a paradigm shift. It is not something we learn from a textbook and dispense. A restorative approach comes from a different mindset, a different heart set. And so you can take a rules-based, punishment-driven, retributive justice system. And of course, anyone can make that work, because all you do is you just turn up the volume on the enforcement and the punishment, and you can control the behaviour of the people. And I'm not just talking about students. You can control the behaviour of your staff team if you make the place punitive enough. And then, of course, there's a further issue that even for a school that says, you know, we really do want to introduce restorative practices, that doesn't come anywhere in Ofsted. Mm. There's no prizes for that. There's no tick box for that. And so you'll be introducing a process, a system, a philosophy within a framework where the regulator can still punish you. And so that makes it very hard. It's I would say in the current climate, it's a courageous thing for a school to do. But I hope during this talk, what we'll discover is how, when you can go through the growing pains that anything new invariably has, it will save time, it will build community, and it will create a collaborative workspace for the staff and the students and the parents where conflict will not escalate because there are processes in place to notice things much earlier and to create emotional safety.
Yeah, and that point about emotional safety, linked to actually the thing that came immediately before it. One of the things I vividly remember from your training was the very first question: what is conflict? And everyone in the room had their own definition of conflict. And I remember you saying, no, conflict is the inevitable result of having two people in the same room. And that leads us to need to notice, as you said a moment ago, we need to be able to notice things earlier in order to stop escalation of conflict into the kind of disputes or toxic things that can happen in organisations. So what do we have to connect with to notice stuff earlier?
So people give off signals, I mean, from what they say and how they behave. There are very, very early warning signs. Mm. Now, the issue is that those early warning signs, now what we've done is rather than take a restorative approach, taking an approach that's based in our common humanity and the absolutely innate desire in all of us to live in harmony with our values. What we've done is we've just created more and more legislation. So never before has an employer had so much responsibility towards the psychological well-being of their staff. And never before has a school had so much responsibility to look after the children that are in their care to almost parental levels. And so you can keep legislating this. And while, you know, whoever said don't introduce restorative practices because if it's done badly, it will go wrong, I see lots and lots of retributive justice done really badly. It's not taking us to a good place, is it? I mean, the tribunals, the employment tribunals are backed up.
Yeah.
I mean, the courts are backed up. You know, you know, I know people in legal disputes that are still in these legal disputes 3 years later. So it's not like that's working, is it? Let's be, you know, that's not working, is it?
That doesn't strike me as the number one quality of something that's worked when it's still going wrong 3 years later. No.
Yeah, precisely. Yeah. So so what does it take? I say it takes courage in today's world. It takes courage. And interestingly, I'd like to bring this in. It's a bit controversial, but in 2015, I made this decision that I wasn't going into another school or prison until I found a senior leadership team. And I was saying, it's got to be a school or a prison who understood that they would have to undergo a shift and they would have to build this into their regime. It would have to be built in. So there would have to be changes coming at a senior leadership level. And it was easier to find a prison than a school to take it on. And I think there's something very sad about that.
And what did that tell you?
It told me that for schools, the pressures and the lack of resources and the stress that, not that they're not, haven't got that in prisons, don't get me wrong, but the stress, the lack of resources and the pressure from the regulatory body, whatever, you know, the Ofsteds of this world, are so great that management are afraid to take risks.
And I think it's really instructive that in comparing schools and prisons, it was harder for you to find a situation, a leadership team or a senior leader in a school than it was to find one in a prison. And we know how difficult and stressful and how pressured and how overcrowded the prisons are. So to be able to compare schools in that way is really instructive.
It's so, and you've got to remember that once upon a time, so I've been going into school since 2001, and once upon a time in Ofsted, student voice was one of the tick boxes, and And that provided us with a vehicle or a reason for a conversation. Yeah. And sometimes in some of those stricter schools, because they were getting all these accolades and then failing miserably on student voice.
Yeah.
Because that's the part where the Ofsted people would actually talk to the students.
Mm.
And so we could go in and create some balance. But student voice disappeared. I mean, that's kind of how unrestorative can you get to remove the beneficiaries of the system from the decision making and from asking them what they want and whether they feel their voices are heard.
Yeah, it's going to be interesting to compare the new Ofsted framework with, you know, what's gone before it to see how that moves on, if at all. I certainly hope it does. So, if a school, and we could apply this to anywhere, but let's take a school because we're talking about education. If a school were to establish a culture in which restorative approaches really worked and really did drive beneficial change, what things would have to happen? What would they have to do?
So, firstly, we don't go anywhere near the students, the children, the young people, until the adults have this and that they're modelling it and practising it. And so what does that mean? What are the models for dispute resolution? What's happening in the staff room? What are the factions? Who's gossiping about what? Where what is happening here that needs resolving so that as a staff team, you know, I haven't, it's a sad indictment. You know, I haven't been in a school where there haven't been problems between middle management and senior management.
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been in a school where that's seamless and working in harmony. Mm. So the first thing I do is give a talk on what this is going to mean and how we're going to start to work things out as the adults. And then the adults need to talk to the parents. Then the parents need to be involved. So you're building a safe container for the young children, the young people, the students, the pupils, whatever language you want to use. You're creating a safe container in which these things are being modelled.
Yeah.
So one of the things I do is I give talks to parents about how they might engage restoratively in their parenting.
Mm.
Because often parents are not really listening. You know, I mean, it's the complaint that all children give. No one's listening.
Yeah.
No one's listening. Yeah. No one's listening. And that's not a socioeconomic thing.
Mm.
I've got children in deep poverty, you know, where resources and deprivation are on the floor, who say their parents aren't listening, but equally very, very wealthy parents where the kids say parents aren't listening.
Yeah.
You know, they'll give them anything materially, but do anything but listen. And I know that sounds very pejorative or whatever, you know, but I see that at all levels of society.
Yeah.
Children say adults don't listen. That I can guarantee you.
So
first of all, we got to build the container and that will take a while. Because we need a deeper understanding of the shift we're making.
Yeah.
Because you see, we're making a shift into trusting in our humanity.
Yeah.
And our systems teach us not to trust humanity. Our systems teach us that there is a rule, and if the rule gets broken, someone gets punished for it, or there's some kind of enforcement around it.
Yeah.
And what that does is it stops people doing the natural internal reflection of who am I?
Yeah.
How do I fit into my community? What is the giving and receiving? Mm. How am I of service? And how is the system in service of me?
Mm.
And how am I in service of the system? So we're looking at individually, collectively, and systemic of what are the fundamental human needs that we want to meet and how are we going to meet them so that we're not beating people into doing it because that's very superficial. If I hold the power, I can get anyone to do anything.
Mm.
I can manipulate, I can persuade, I can threaten, I could get anyone to do anything if I hold the power.
Yeah.
Especially if people are worried about their jobs or their credibility or their reputations. You know, you can manipulate anything. But did anyone do it because they wanted to, because they chose to be of service? And you see what really saddens me in the education system? The thing that breaks my heart is no one goes into teaching because they wanted to make money or make a name for themselves or nobody. That is, becoming a teacher is a selfless, it's a selfless vocational calling. Tisn't, I know they did a whole thing about you could, you know, nullify your student loan if you did tip. It doesn't matter. Only people that have some kind, something somewhere calls them to teaching. And then we take those selfless human beings and we exploit them and we take and take and take with very little support for their well-being and their care. Because if we want them to care for the children, we have to pour love into them, not punitive, not punitive, like, you know, be worried and sit up till midnight marking papers. You know, so what goes on, what we've actually done is we've stripped away our humanity. There's nothing, there's no work of the soul going on. There's no work of our humanity going on. We've stripped that all away and made everything tick box process, get it done. There's, you can never do enough. It's never done. It's never complete. And there's always something else. And you're always just that little bit behind and you're always failing and you're always too tired. This is not, we can't treat our teachers and our pastoral care staff and anyone else that is involved in the care of our young people, we cannot treat them like this. So, okay, so that's very huge. So there are lots of things that we can do at a restorative level as a group of people to say, okay, so there is a bigger system. And the bigger system, you know, there's only so far we can go before we'll hit up against the boundaries of it. So we do need to satisfy that system, but we don't need to treat each other badly in the process. In the process, we can laugh at it. We cannot let it define who we are, and we can collaboratively work towards meeting those goals and targets with the least amount of human suffering. And when we get that, and it doesn't take long, for people to break free of the chains, and we start to see that actually, I love going to my place of work. I can find the joy in it. And I've got a senior management team. And I'm happy to make their life easier because they make my life easier. And we're happy to see that, of course, we're going to make mistakes. Of course, we're going to have to be vulnerable. Of course, we're going to try things and take a few risks here and there. And some of them will pay off and some of them won't. And we go to, let's be human and then and be really savvy about the system and meet the demands of the system. Not saying that we're not going on any kind of weird rebellion.
Yeah.
We're going to meet the demands of the system in a loving, kind, gentle way where we're doing this together.
Then
we can begin to think about what that means in the classroom, what that means for the students, for the families, for their futures, for our own future. And then we can begin skills and techniques and what that means. How do I take this paradigm and apply it?
Absolutely. Wow. Whew, need to take a deep breath. So one of the things that really resonated for me there was kind of pertains to our previous conversation about human flourishing, which is you cannot expect an education system or indeed an individual school to enable young people to flourish if the teachers aren't flourishing.
Absolutely.
It is completely impossible.
Yeah.
And that valuing of teachers and appreciating and you know, you talked about pouring love into them, I think is a really key thing. And so many of the schools I've visited and seen some amazing leadership in action, it has been really characterized by that selfless devotion to enabling all the staff in the school to be the best that they can be in their role. So they don't feel threatened. They don't feel constantly, you know, as if they're on surveillance and that kind of thing. And the other thing it sparked for me is I read a brilliant thing last week that I'll credit to two people because it kind of came from two. But Shane Leaning, who is someone we've worked with quite a lot, is a very good friend and colleague, is based in Shanghai, he's an organisational coach, and Sam Gibbs, who's Director of Education in Greater Manchester Education Trust, about systems that are fundamentally designed to be surveillance to catch out the thing that's going, the person that's doing something wrong or the thing. Whereas starting from the place of, well, everyone's trying to do the right thing and what can we do to support that? Rather than how can we catch people out? And I think there's a really interesting thing there.
Well, I look at things like teacher training and training of social workers. Yeah. And what happens is you've got beautiful people wanting to do something vocational, wanting to make their contribution in some way, going through a process. And because it's so incremental over the course of the degree or whatever that training is, coming out as enforcers. And they don't see the change. They don't see that they started out this way and now they've come out to look out for the bad kids, to look for, you know, how to become an enforcer of a system that actually is inherently unwilling to concede to our common humanity.
Yeah, interesting. So taking that a stage further, one of the things that you taught me a long time ago was a lot of people's first instinct when they think about restorative approaches is it's a way, like a way forward is you need to get people to compromise, and you told me that's the absolute worst thing you could ever aim for. So I wonder whether you might expand on that a little bit more.
Absolutely, thank you. So for me, compromise is the worst possible position for humans, because compromise suggests that in the pursuit of a bigger or greater good, I gave something up.
Yeah.
Gave something up in the pursuit of something greater, right, for a greater good. Now, if I gave something up in the pursuit of a greater good, it doesn't go away. It doesn't, I don't suddenly not want that anymore. So for me, there's a deeper process, which again sits in a restorative mindset or a restorative heart set. And that is, it's not about compromise, it's about change. So when I've internally completely changed, and we can only do that when we've connected and met each other and understood each other. And the measurement for that, so the measurement that I use in a restorative justice framework is injury, loss, or harm.
Yeah.
That's the measurement.
Yeah.
What is the actual or perceived injury, loss, or harm that has come out of what has happened or that has the potential to happen if we're looking forward?
Yeah.
So where we want to get to is stuff happens and then we have processes in place, which I can describe in more depth. We have processes in place that we can follow that that sit within the values that will take us, and everybody knows that's what we do. And before that, so the idea is that you know, when stuff happens, we've got a process that we're all trained in and we understand and we can take things to resolution. And if we're operating from a restorative point of view, we get to the point where we can identify what we might do and talk about it before the behaviour comes out, because it's safe enough to do so.
Yeah.
I'm not constantly sitting on a time bomb.
Yeah.
So you create a place in safety where I can come to someone and say, that upset me or hurt me so much that my first instinct is I want to retaliate.
Yeah.
But I'm telling you before I retaliate.
Yeah, yeah.
And then you can talk me off the ledge, because we know how to do that.
Yeah.
And that's what happens is it usually takes 3 years to embed something like this. It's a three-year process.
Yeah.
To really, because the first year it's all sort of trial and error.
Yeah.
And then the second year, you've got a lot of people who are interested and people are trying things, and we've worked out what doesn't work.
Yeah.
And then when I work in school, it's not prescribed. Yeah. I can't tell any school that you have to do it this way or that way.
Yeah.
We've got a number of tools at our disposal.
Yeah.
And I like to work alongside until we find what's going to work in this school with the population this school has.
Mm.
And what things are just not going to work or we can't make work. And so it varies from school to school.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, I worked in one primary school where I absolutely had a head teacher who just bought into this. You know, she just completely got it.
Yeah.
And she said, okay, so the first thing we're going to do is when kids are distracted and they go and sit at this table at the back.
Mm.
She said, you know, the reflection place or whatever.
Yeah.
She said, we're going to use nonviolent communication and human needs.
Mm.
And the kids are going to reflect on what needs are not being met. And then we've got these metaphors of the jackal and the giraffe.
Yeah.
And so they had a place to go where there was some stuff they could actually really benefit from.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Not so it wasn't the naughty corner anymore.
Yeah, yeah.
It was just a place to go when
you're
so full you can't learn anymore.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely.
So we give children an opportunity to have an outlet for that.
Yeah.
I mean, how likely is it you're going to put 30 kids in a class and they're all going to be able to sit and learn at the same time?
Well, absolutely. And I think the challenges that are facing teachers every day in their schools would bear that out. You know, it's difficult. What you've just described there really makes it clearer, I think, to our listeners how if you're going to embark on this, it requires commitment, like a really deep commitment. It's going to take 3 years to make this sort of thing work and embed really, really effectively. And I wonder whether, you know, because schools are judged so instantly and it's about, you know, trying to make transformative change very, very quickly, whether there's just too much to expect there, that for schools to say, well, actually, this is going to be a journey. It's going to take us not just 3 years, but probably, you know, ongoing. It's 5 or 6 or 7 years down the road where we're actually going to have a different culture at the end of that 7 years. And it reminded me of something you said earlier about making decisions for 7 generations' time, not just 7 years' time. How difficult we maybe find it as a society these days to think in the long term, you know. A politician is going to make decisions that make them more likely to be re-elected next time, which might be 2 years, it might be 4 years, it might be 1 year. We don't know. In the case of a head teacher, for example, they want their contract to be renewed at the end of, let's say, they have a 5-year contract, which is not, you know, it's not universal, but it's not abnormal. I want another contract. Well, that means I've got to show demonstrable change in that kind of period of time.
So an individual isn't going to be able to do this.
Yeah.
But, you know, I could draw a really nice parallel or example with the relationship with Wellington College.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, it was 2013
and
nothing happens fast here for good reasons, for good reasons. It was 2013 when I first came in and I I did a sort of audit.
Yeah.
And I reported back on you know, it's like, what does an outsider see when they come on campus for lots and lots of time and just observe what's going on? And I made my observations, and bit by bit, you know, we do what we can.
Yeah.
But where have we ended up? We do have six or seven people fully trained, and it sits alongside, doesn't it? As I understand it, we have a dialogue roadmap process that sits alongside the daily. It doesn't interrupt. Yeah, exactly. Nobody's haven't had to turn the school upside down.
No.
But there is this place that people can go when they feel like they're falling out of sync for whatever reason.
Yeah.
And this process will hold them. It will care for that person. It will sit alongside them until they feel they can jump back in again.
Yeah.
Well, that's just that's not difficult to do.
No.
And it provides a lot of value. And for me, that's very restorative.
Yeah. And maybe that's instructive for people to see that the way in which this kind of approach and this way of being can be intertwined and enmeshed into a school's culture that is really formative and is really practical and pragmatic. You can do it. I think maybe some schools are kind of scared off by the idea because they're probably, most schools are resource poor in some in some way. It's a struggle to recruit enough teachers with the right qualifications and background to do everything that needs to be done and so on. And most teachers are teaching way more contact time than they used to be. It's just the nature of how things have gone. And how can you do this? Well, maybe there's a salutary lesson there that you know, you can make this add to and intertwine with your existing setup in a perfectly sensible way.
I remember taking, because part of this, you know, I said there are lots of processes and tools that apply it, and part of it is peer mediation.
Yeah.
Well, my version of peer mediation is quite different and a bit more radical, I'd say, than the standard peer mediation process. But I remember taking this into a secondary school in East London. And after the training, I go back and I say, rather than saying, and this is how you will use it, I go back and I sit with the kids and say, how do you want to use it? Where do you think this is going to have the most value?
Yeah.
And what they said, I mean, I thought it was marvellous. And they were allowed to implement it. They said, well, when a kid gets in trouble for the first time, like uniform or, you know, no homework or whatever, and it's minor, but it's their first time in trouble, could they send them to us?
So
we can talk to them and find out what's wrong.
Yeah.
Also, I mean, how amazing that a bunch of 14, 15-year-olds said, that's what we want you to do with the, you know, the years sevens and eights and nines.
Yeah. And what was the impact of that?
The school implemented it and students were having a word, and it took a pressure off the adults.
I had the words pressure cooker in my mind as you said that. It just, your whole energy just, it was like a release of steam.
Well, interestingly, there was another primary school that we did this work in, and they kept it going for several years. And when we surveyed the kids after the first year of them having peer mediators, because what we had to train the teachers was like, so don't get involved in the petty squabbles.
Mm.
There's plenty of stuff that adults need to be involved in. And if you're involved in the petty squabbles, you'll never see the kid that really needs help. So don't just, like, the mindset is take that to peer mediation. Take that to peer mediation. Mm. And you know what the kids said? We love it because it means the teachers can get on with teaching.
Yeah.
The kids said that.
Yeah, yeah.
We like that the teachers can get on with teaching.
Yeah, yeah. One of the things that you hear from perhaps the doubters, the naysayers, to do with restorative practice is it's some approximation of this. It's oh, well, all you do, you just can do whatever you like, but as long as you say sorry, everything's okay, you could just walk away from it. Which really riles me. And I can imagine it riles you probably in a slightly more measured way. But what do you say to that?
Well, that's probably what your speaker was referring to about when you do it badly.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, there was a lot of really bad RJ training going on, you know, superficial stuff that doesn't sit well with our core humanity and the values that we're trying to bring into the community. So for me, I mean, I don't even like apology. Apology for me is too superficial.
Yeah.
What I'm looking for in a conversation is true, authentic expressions of remorse and regret.
Yeah.
And that's not the same as saying sorry.
No.
Sorry is such a shortcut to real human connection. And just because you said sorry doesn't heal me instantly. That's not the end of it. How can I even trust your sorry?
We
don't know what your sorry means until we've looked back and seen that actually that was authentic. So what we're, when I go back to the injury, loss or harm, what restorative practice is for everybody who's been impacted. So the person who did it, the people who were directly impacted, people who are indirectly impacted, and other members of the community. The question is, how do we get back to safety? What is it we need to do? We, not you. Because often things come out of a system that that needed to support something. Okay? So the question is, what is it we need to do? And it brings the person who did it face to face. So they're having to come face to face with the impact that they had on others, directly or indirectly. And that's a lot harder and harsher. Don't call these soft skills.
No, exactly.
You probably hear from the way I talk. You know, what I do are not soft skills.
No, it's I can vouch for that. It's hard work.
It's compassionate.
It's
using language in a way that supports humanity. But believe me, I don't leave any stone unturned.
No, no, exactly.
And so it's bringing people face to face with the impact of what they did, how they responded, and what are the timed, measurable actions that we're going to take, and how will we know if it worked?
Yeah, absolutely. And that that whole idea that something that maybe starts as a conflict, it becomes a dispute between two people. The knock-on effect of that is always wider than we realise, and there could be contributory factors feeding into that, as well as impacts and effects that come out of it. So I think, again, there's a tendency for people to oversimplify this. And like, we have an argument between two people, so we effect some kind of charade of a conversation to somehow, supposedly in inverted commas, repair the damage because, well, so-and-so said sorry and they've agreed to sort of make up and go on. But nothing's actually solved because nothing's changed. And like you just said, measurable actions.
Timed
and
measurable.
Timed measurable actions, absolutely. And how will we know if they've worked?
And so the interesting thing is that, you know, as a leader, when you're, you know, going through these repair processes in the sort of mainstream way, firstly, everyone else is going, is this fair? Yeah. Might not say it out loud.
Yeah.
Is this fair? Because often it isn't fair.
Because
often decisions and judgments have been taken without really understanding the source or the root of the issue.
Yeah.
So people are looking at that and going, is that fair? And often it's not. And then that's going to have a ripple effect across your community, where people are no longer going to tell you the truth. People are going to stop telling the truth. They're going to cover up, hide things, I mean, I think one of the most fantastic things I ever heard was So the person who excels in this work and who I learned from is someone called Dominic Barter, who developed something called restorative circles. And he really is the master. He works in Brazil in the favelas. And he heard some kids talking and they said, here's the problem. The problem is that adults don't like us fighting. So because adults don't like us fighting, we have to take our fights out of the sight of adults. And that's when it gets dangerous. I mean, that's just genius, isn't it?
So we
want children to be able to have their fights in safe spaces. I can teach you how to have a fight that leads to something very creative and beautiful, not something destructive.
Absolutely. So a lot of this really comes from the need to notice where and acknowledge where there's been injury, loss or harm. And I wonder whether you might just expand a little bit more on what for you represents injury, loss or harm and what doesn't.
Yeah, so there's injury, loss or harm to self, other or system.
Yeah.
And so it has to be tangible. We have to be able to see it. You know, it's not descriptive. It's evidential. So you threw the ball at someone and it hit them in the face. So I didn't say you dangerously threw the ball, you know what I mean?
It's in order to try to hurt.
So we'd be able to watch it on a video and we'd see the same thing. And I really want to make this clear. So there's tangible injury, loss or harm that we can name and point to, and we can see where it happened, who was involved. And that's really paramount to this. But hurt feelings is not injury, loss or harm. You know, for me, hurt feelings is the beginning of a very important conversation. And I know, like in coaching, maybe you can speak to what feelings are in coaching.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, it's something we really try and focus on when we're training coaches and developing them and so on, that our feelings and our emotions need noticing, but not because they are absolutely fundamentally important in their own right, but because they're a pointer to something. They're a pointer to values. They're a pointer to needs. They're, to really simplify it, you'd say emotions that are broadly positive and feelings that are broadly positive. And we can think of lots of examples of those, are usually an indication that some need or some value of yours is being lived out or promoted or nurtured or caressed or whatever it is. And conversely, feelings and emotions that manifest themselves negatively are almost always some pointer to the fact that a need or a value is being trampled on or compromised or not lived out or something like that. And we feel these every day. We witness something. If we have a massive value around fairness, let's say, and we witness something unfair, that's going to bristle us. It's going to make us, if someone was going to try and maybe belittle or diminish coaching as a concept, as a thing, they would say, oh, yeah, coaching, that's just that thing where you say, oh, how does that make you feel? Well, the answer is, well, it doesn't, because nothing can make you feel anything. It is our response to what is there, and it is pretty much always a link, a pointer, a signpost to values and needs. And I know we did a lot on values and needs in the DRM training back in the day.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'm really happy to hear that, because if we just rely on, this made me feel a certain way, and then we focus on that,
we've missed everything.
We've missed everything, because our feelings, feeling is the difference between being alive and dead.
Yeah, exactly. Right?
It's actually the difference. It's probably the one thing a robot isn't going to go back to the AI. The robot isn't going to be able to.
It's one thing we have to do in a first aid course, isn't it? It's
absolutely.
Like, you're like, are they responsive or not?
Yeah. And so for me, feelings are our body's natural alarm system to tell us to pull over and look under the bonnet and take the oil stick or whatever it is, you know, check the tyres or whatever. Look underneath, look at the engine and see what's not working. And the feelings are a natural alarm system for that. So to just end at feelings misses the whole point of what we're talking about, which is it's a gateway in. So now, if we explore that, let's say you picked fairness. So what it leads to is when I saw that happen, my need for fairness was not met. Right. And so what does that mean? How is that just perception on my part? Because doesn't mean I'm right.
Is that just
perception on my part? And if I had a greater understanding of what actually went, I could see. And then also, who promised anyone that life would be fair? Right? You know, how close to the surface is your fairness button? Because it might not be realistic. And then if it does point to something that's inherently unfair, how can we repair that? Now we're truly being restorative.
Absolutely. And I loved hearing you say that about like our perception of what's happened isn't always like we have a particular view on it. And our view informs our reality in that moment. But is there one true reality? Is there one truth? Well, probably not in most situations. Sometimes it can be, but we can ascribe significance to an action that might ring all sorts of alarm bells. That's unfair, that's unfair, that's unfair in the example we've been using. But that's just our perspective on it. You know, anybody's reality in any moment is a mixture of, well, what's actually happened? What, like you said, what could you watch back on a videotape and would be demonstrably the same thing whoever watched it? And what do you perceive of that? What's your perspective on it? And our feelings, our reactions come from, I mean, in great part, what is our perspective on it compared to what the actual thing was.
And then also, am I reacting to what I saw? Or am I reacting to the 50 times it's happened before and it's never been attended to? So this is just another manifestation of something unhealed in me. Right? But also then we can then look at, if we go to what is the actual injury, loss or harm, then we can go, but that actually now crosses a line into abuse. That crosses a line into violence. That crosses a line into coercive control or, you know, whatever. And society has lots of protections for that. You know, we do have boundaries. There are boundaries in life that says, you know, as a group of people, we don't allow that behaviour. And if you decide to bump up against that boundary, we've got certain things in place to let you know in no uncertain terms that, you know, we don't tolerate that. And that's absolutely fine. But for me, it's about, you don't go from A to B in one jump. There's a process to get there of making sure that we've examined everything. I mean, you know, if I take that into the criminal justice system, because of the number of people in remand, on remand in prison, do you know that it's likely that 22% of all people in prison are actually innocent? That is a statistic. So
that's right.
How is that helping society?
Well, on that bombshell, which maybe opens up some further episodes, I just want to have a huge thank you to Maria for joining me today and in these episodes. And we look forward very much to more. Maria, thank you very much indeed.
Oh, Ian, this is like a dream for me. I mean, this, it couldn't be better to come here and sit and talk to you and talk with you and share ideas is my idea of heaven. Thank you.
Thank you. Wow. Well, where do I start? That was just a spellbinding conversation with Maria. I absolutely love talking to her, listening to her and learning from her. And there's some really big questions here. The number of ways in which restorative approaches can be maybe misrepresented and misapplied, which mean that the benefit of those really can get lost. And I'm wondering what you've taken away from this conversation today. Do you understand a little bit more about the long-term commitment to really wanting to change a culture over a period of time? Do you have a long-term enough view for that? Have you been focusing maybe too much on a resolution, which appears like a resolution, like an apology or a compromise, when maybe something really considerably deeper than that was where you needed to be? But I hope you've enjoyed that episode. It's been a joy to be with Maria for these three, and we look forward to more sometime in the future. Amen. If you found any of these conversations interesting, and I'm sure you have, we're delighted to have Maria coming to work with us next term on the 27th of January. She's doing a session on addressing staff room conflicts. On the 24th of March, another really crucial one on managing relationships with parents. Do get in touch with us at The Bridge if you're interested in taking part in these. Please leave a comment, ask a question, and like, follow, and subscribe to hear more from Bridge Ed. You can also follow The Bridge on LinkedIn, and you can find out more information on our website at thebridge.wellingtoncollege.org.uk. Until next time.